Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Matt Wood of the media democracy group Free Press, who examines the Trump regime's explicit policy of censoring administration critics by using the Federal Communications Commission to suppress free speech. Elizabeth Jacobs, professor emeritus in epidemiology at the University of Arizona, who shares her views on President Trump and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s recent claim that Tylenol is linked to autism and Florida's move to end vaccine mandates for school children. And Armin Alex, co-founder of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit, who talks about the recent petrostate tour in Washington, D.C., focusing attention on the fight against fossil fuel pollution in the Gulf South that's making residents sick. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is warning of a growing humanitarian crisis as more than 176,000 Sahrawi refugees from Western Sahara in Algerian camps are suffering from malnutrition due to a reduction in humanitarian aid resulting from lack of funding. Aline Rumange, the World Food Program's country director in Algeria, told Foreign Policy magazine, "Those women and children are living in the desert and depend 100% on humanitarian assistance." Algeria has hosted Sahrawi refugees in camps since neighboring Morocco annexed part of Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony, in 1975, which displaced more than 100,000 people. Morocco now controls around 80% of the disputed territory, while Algeria backs Western Sahara's Polisario Front, which controls the territory's other 20% and seeks independence and the right to self-determination. During Donald Trump's first term in office, he broke precedent by recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara in exchange for Morocco normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel. Doctors and public health experts are raising an alarm about the growing spread of tuberculosis among prisoners held in ICE detention centers. Migrant detainees have tested positive for TB, the world's most deadly infectious disease, in Alaska and California detention centers. A detainee died in ICE custody in an Arizona detention center one day after he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Other detainees in both Colorado and Washington State have also been exposed to TB. A recent lawsuit was filed against the Department of Homeland Security over what the plaintiffs say are dirty and overcrowded conditions at Manhattan's 26 Federal Plaza Detention Center. In mid-August, a judge ordered ICE to improve the conditions immediately. Dr. Leonardo Martinez, assistant professor of epidemiology at Boston University, says, "There is no good reason why tuberculosis is spreading in ICE detention. He and other medical experts are calling on the CDC to control outbreaks and for federal detention sites to provide proper screening, isolation, and care, and above all, to follow their own preventative health protocols." Pharmacies in Black and Latino communities are less likely to dispense the anti-opioid drug buprenorphine in treating opioid addiction than in white communities. This is occurring as pharmacies are cautious in dispensing the anti-opioid drug, which is classified as a controlled substance. The drug helps reduce cravings for opioids and the likelihood of a fatal overdose. While the overall rate of such deaths in the U.S. has declined, it has risen among Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities. Many public health experts fear that Trump and the Republican Party's deep cuts to the Medicaid program will worsen the opioid crisis by increasing the number of people without health insurance, which is expected to climb by about 10 million by 2034. Health researchers from Boston University and the University of Pennsylvania estimate that 156,000 Medicaid patients will lose access to medications for opioid addiction, leading to over 1,000 more overdose deaths annually. Among pharmacies who dispense the anti-opioid drug, there's a major disparity. Buprenorphine is 18% less likely to be available in Black and Latino neighborhoods compared to 46% of pharmacies in mostly white communities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump returned to the White House in January, the nation has witnessed an escalating pattern of verbal attacks, lawsuits, and threats to revoke broadcast licenses targeting media outlets that carry commentary or other programming critical of the president. Companies and programs attacked include CBS, ABC, 60 Minutes, The Wall Street Journal, and the Associated Press. The regime's policy of suppressing free speech came into sharp focus when Trump's FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr threatened ABC Disney Corporation with retaliation if it didn't suspend late-night TV host Jimmy Kimmel for remarks he made on his show about the assassination of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. Within hours on September 17th, ABC complied by suspending Kimmel's show indefinitely. But the backlash to Trump's heavy-handed government censorship, not seen in the U.S. since the McCarthy era, was fierce. A consumer boycott to cancel Disney's streaming service was quickly launched, and within 5 days succeeded in pressuring ABC to reinstate Kimmel's show that was back on the air on September 23rd. But a quarter of local ABC affiliate stations, owned by Sinclair and Nexstar, say they'll continue to preempt Kimmel's show. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wood, Vice President of Policy and General Counsel with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he examines Donald Trump's attempt to control the nation's media content and the surrender of many media industry CEOs to authoritarianism, turning their backs on the nation's First Amendment protections for free speech.
One place to start here is to talk about the incredibly self-serving and hypocritical view that this president and a lot of his supporters seem to have about the First Amendment. They seem to think it means that powerful people, and typically white men, but you know, all sorts of powerful people, but especially these tech billionaires and others who helped him get into office this time, they can say whatever they want without consequence. And if anybody, including an individual or a company, you know, even a large platform, or now we're seeing news outlets as well, doesn't agree with that point of view expressed by whether it's a public or a private individual, well, that's a free speech violation, right? So if I tune you out, I'm somehow violating your free speech in their worldview. And that's, of course, completely wrong. The First Amendment is about Congress and by extension, the rest of our government not making any laws that abridge freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And so, you know, there's just all sorts of grievances that people like Trump and Musk, and we can go on down the list, have and make about their supposed free expression. And of course, they're free to say whatever they want. The First Amendment comes into play when government takes action. And that's exactly what we've seen from Trump so many times.
Matt, FCC Chair Brendan Carr, a co-author of Project 2025, has said his action to take Jimmy Kimmel off the air is just the beginning of cancellations and censorship. And then, of course, just the other day, Trump explicitly said he wants to revoke FCC TV licenses from outlets that criticize him. How should our listeners and the public in general respond to this really dire threat to the First Amendment and free speech?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think we're still in the information gathering and organizing mode. There's been an outcry from Congress and even from people on the other side of the aisle, from Brendan Carr. Even Senator Ted Cruz, who chairs the powerful Senate Commerce Committee, expressed disapproval about Carr's actions last week. You know, you mentioned Carr and Trump's plans. It's I refer to this in another interview I did as not very sophisticated gaslighting. They really want to have it both ways. As I talked about the companies talking out of both sides of their mouths, I might as well mention Donald Trump and Brendan Carr's version of that. You know, after this happened, you saw Brendan Carr trying to backpedal and say, oh, no, you know, this was an ABC decision. It's about ratings. It's a business decision. I had nothing to do with it. Meanwhile, Trump is crowing about getting Kimmel off the air. And what Brendan Carr said that precipitated a lot of this last week, it was only 5 days ago, as of the time you and I are talking here. Brendan Carr said, well, we don't like what Jimmy Kimmel said. The president doesn't like it. Whoever he's pretending to speak for doesn't like it. And so if these stations don't take action and rein in his conduct, then we can do this the easy way or the hard way, he said, trying to sound tough. And he said, if they don't change their behavior, then there'll be more work for the FCC to do. So there's really no mistaking the threat there, even though in trying to cover their mistakes, cover their overreach, there was some backpedaling from at least Brendan Carr, not from Trump himself, who can't help but crow about these things. And Carr said, I had nothing to do with it, which is plainly the opposite of the intent he wanted and got in the middle of last week. So you're right. I mean, I don't see this stopping anytime soon. At freepress.net, that's our website, we have different call tools. So you can call your local ABC station and express your disapproval of this kind of maneuvering and censorship. We're talking about what Congress can do. This, as I said, there's been a lot of great energy in Congress. I don't think it's really coalesced around any one action. And, you know, I'll finish here. The reason this is sometimes hard to fight, even though it's my job, and that's what we've been doing at Free Press for a long time, not just this administration, but previous ones too, is what we're seeing is this corruption now is just out there in plain sight. You know, there's no hiding it. They're actually quite proud of it. And so I think a really important thing is just to stand up and say no and call it out. And, you know, what we can do to change the law or prevent these kinds of things from happening in the future is sometimes tough to answer because this is already unlawful. There are already provisions in the Communications Act that say the FCC can't exercise the power of censorship or try to dictate content on television and radio stations just because it grants them licenses. So, you know, this stuff is already outside of the norm. It's already beyond the pale. And that's why I think sometimes it's hard to even know where it's coming from or what we can do about it. First step is just calling it out and refusing to comply in advance or comply on the basis of threats coming from the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. I think the news of Jimmy Kimmel being reinstated is important, but we're not done with this story because we have yet to see what he's going to say when he comes back. We have yet to know whether the network affiliates, not ABC itself, but companies like Nexstar and Sinclair will even air his show. And then even if everything falls into place and this corporate pressure and pressure on the government worked, there's a lot more work for us to do because we simply can't have a government trying to dictate what its opponents or even anybody can say. And that's what we're facing, and that's what we're trying to fight back against at freepress.net and with the other tools that we have.
That was Matt Wood, Vice President of Policy and General Counsel with the media democracy group Free Press. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump regime's suppression of free speech by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. There's been increasing concern about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership as Donald Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary after he fired all 17 members of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and replaced them with many new members who share his anti-vaccine views. The CDC's Advisory Committee met and voted on September 19th against recommending that a prescription be required to get a COVID-19 vaccination, but opposed recommending the vaccine for all adults, leaving it up to individuals. The panel also voted to change a recommendation on the combined measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox vaccine, supporting separate instead of combined shots for children under the age of 4. Experts with the Infectious Diseases Society of America expressed concern about last week's Vaccine Advisory Board meeting that they described as chaotic and were alarmed that some committee members presented false claims about vaccine safety. Your reporter spoke with Elizabeth Jacobs, Professor Emeritus in Epidemiology at the Mel and Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. Here she shares her views on President Trump and RFK Jr.'s recent claim, without evidence, that acetaminophen, the active ingredient in the pain reliever Tylenol, was a cause of autism. She also comments on action taken by Florida state officials to end vaccine mandates for school children.
Once again, Mr. Kennedy and the other group of people over there in HHS are mistaking correlation or association with causation. The major pediatric groups and obstetric groups have repeatedly said that acetaminophen or Tylenol during pregnancy is safe and effective, and in fact, much safer than other painkillers. There have been some studies that have indicated an association between the use of painkillers and the later development of autism spectrum disorder. However, many of those studies do not control for the condition that led to a mother taking acetaminophen in the first place. So if it was a fever, for example, fevers themselves are associated with an increased risk of autism spectrum disorder. So it's really complicated. And the one study that made me really convinced that acetaminophen is not a cause of autism was a big one that was published last year with more than 1 million children. They found that there was no association when they used siblings as the control group. And that's important in short because it controls for both genetic and environmental exposures.
Professor Jacobs, I'd like you to comment briefly on what we've seen come out of Florida recently, where Governor Ron DeSantis, an unsuccessful presidential candidate, and I believe he's term limited now, but DeSantis and his public health coordinator are moving forward with the idea that the state of Florida will do away with vaccine mandates for school-age children. This idea may already be spreading to legislatures across the country in conservative-controlled states. Tell us a little bit about what you see happening in Florida that may spread across the country.
So what I see happening in Florida is a tragedy. So about 15 years ago when I started studying vaccine exemptions or people who opted out of getting their children vaccinated, one of the conclusions I came to is that the most important barrier to rampant vaccine preventable disease outbreaks are childhood vaccine requirements for school entry. So in other words, if you want to go to public school, your children do have to be vaccinated against certain diseases, and the state sets those requirements, not the federal government. And so DeSantis is well within his ability to say, we no longer require any vaccinations for school entry. That is clearly going to result in infectious disease outbreaks. There's just no question about it. And with that spreading to other states, again, the lower our vaccination coverage is, the less protected we all are. And it's dangerous and it's tragic. I just can't understand why this is happening.
You know, I think part of the answer to that is that one particular political party, the Republicans, have seen some benefit politically from weaponizing the debate about vaccines. And I'm not sure that any of these folks who are pushing the conspiracy theories that vaccines are horrible and will kill you and all this stuff, I'm not sure they really believe it, but they see a political advantage in pushing that line. Is that something that you're seeing as well?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it's part of an effort of people to maintain their power and influence at the expense of all of us. It's a disgrace. And so when I say I can't understand it, the chickens are going to come home to roost. There are going to be increases in infectious disease. Eventually, unfortunately, the child of people who do believe in vaccines, but perhaps the child is too young to have gotten vaccines, is going to become ill. And there is no way that they will be able to hide at that point. What they have going for them is that it may take 3 or 4 years for the level of vaccination coverage to drop low enough that we start to see really significant infectious disease spread. So they may actually be calculating that, which is even more just repellent.
That was Elizabeth Jacobs, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at the College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. Find more analysis and commentary on widespread criticism of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership at the Department of Health and Human Services by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In mid-September, dozens of climate activists, including many community members from the Gulf South, gathered in Washington, D.C. for 2 days of action. They spent 1 day at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Environmental Protection Agency, and the next day on a petrostate tour of some of the most powerful promoters of fossil fuels, including the American Petroleum Institute, the American Gas Association, the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, and Venture Global, the company responsible for building two enormous liquefied natural gas export terminals in Cameron Parish, Louisiana. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus joined the Petrostate Tour and interviewed Armon Alex, co-founder and co-director of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit, a group of 800 young people from all around the Gulf, from Mexico to the U.S. and the Caribbean, working to protect the Gulf region through education, advocacy, and direct action. Alex was born and raised in Corpus Christi, Texas, on the Gulf Coast, where the city's natural beauty sharply contrasts with six massive fossil fuel refineries that increase the risk of respiratory illnesses and cancers among residents there. Here he describes the origins of the Gulf Youth Climate Summit and its mission.
That was started because there was a lack of youth and a lack of women and a lack of people of color in academic and scientific spaces. And what we recognize is when you have that lack of representation, perspective is lost. Absolutely. It is well documented in science that there's a, such a thing as biased science from a perspective. You simply don't approach a problem in the same way as you would someone with differing perspective and lived experience. But I'm here because my community for far too long, like many others in the U.S. Gulf South, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, have continued to be dubbed as sacrifice zones by oil and gas executives, by politicians who bend the knee to oil and gas money through PACs, etc., and through lobbying efforts. And enough is enough. You know, we've far too long seen way too many of our loved ones quite literally die because of the direct impacts to their health from living next door. And all we want at the end of the day is to live a healthy life so that we can see our grandchildren grow, so that we can see our brothers and our sisters grow, our family members smile at the dining room table. And it's unfortunate that the Gulf South, as much as it is a place of resilience, is also a place where blood is in the water. And so that's why I'm here in D.C. with so many incredible others, comrades and allies here.
The Trump administration is going all out. You know, basically, he promised before the election, if the fossil fuel industry gave him $1 billion, he would deliver for them. And he's doing that in a big way. Really promoting as much as possible, fast-tracking everything to do with fossil fuels and de-tracking anything to do with renewables. What do you want to see happen? What do you think could happen that would benefit your community in the current situation?
From my point of view, living in the Gulf South, we know that any growth for industry quite literally delivers death with it. When this current administration decides that they want to go full throttle on expanding and creating more profit for these greedy billionaires and oil and gas CEOs, we know that that means we will continue to see in an exponential fashion the passing of our loved ones due to the impacts that fossil fuels have in our communities. You know, I think that this also serves as a moment in which we are seeing our communities band together. to push back against this authoritarian regime that we're facing right now. We are helping our family, our friends, people from across the world, our neighbors, gain this consciousness about it's not a left or right issue, but rather a top-heavy to working class people issue. Beyond that, we know that still at the end of the day, the Trump administration is going to expand oil and gas. We need to do and continue to organize our communities to push back. That is at our local levels. That's at our state levels and our federal levels. Of course, he's going to do everything that he can at the federal level. States like mine, like Texas, when you have a governor like ours, or rather in Florida or Louisiana, they're going to continue to push these sacrifice zones. It's quite unfortunate. You know, residents of Texas can't even rely on our state environmental agency because it's a rubber stamp for oil and gas permits. So that's an unreliable place to go. But nevertheless, we should still engage in those spaces so that it is well documented across time that our communities continue to undergo the worst impacts just for some profits. On a local level, there's also work that can be done. We saw this in the first administration, where a lot of the things that he was pushing from the federal level had an opportunity to be delayed and have some defense on local levels because it was up to them to institute some of those things. As it relates to oil and gas expansion on a local level, there is needed cooperation from local cities to be able to push those things forward. And so whether we are here in D.C. or there at a city council meeting in your city, our ability to be able to use our voice and speak up to push back is tangible. When we engage in this kind of defense as a revolutionary act of defiance, we are also in the process of strengthening our muscles to continue this fight. And we're bringing in others. There's been plenty of people that have said in the past, where there are people, there is power.
That was Armon Alex, co-founder and co-director of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit. Learn more about the group and the health crisis many Gulf South residents face who live near polluting fossil fuel refineries and LNG export terminals by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KPRI in Pella, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.